Thanks. For those of you who are clock watching, the rickettsial talk is a little bit brief, so this talk may go on for a little bit longer than timetabled. I've got two cases to present. The first actually was not when I was working at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases, but was in my first year as an infectious diseases trainee in a district hospital in the west of London. And this was a 29-year-old student who had 14 days of fever and dry cough. And he'd seen his general practitioner after he'd been ill for about 10 days, so he'd held off thinking he'd get better. And his GP had prescribed him some amoxicillin, thinking that after 10 days of fever and cough, he probably deserved it. But this had been ineffective. He'd gone back to see his GP because, firstly, the antibiotics had not had any effect on his fever. And secondly, he was worried because he could feel in the left side of his neck a swelling. His GP saw him and was also worried and referred him up to the casualty department saying, I think this guy has lymphoma, he's a young man, he's had fever for 2 weeks, and I think I can feel glands in his neck. Will you please see him urgently? Prior to this, this man had been entirely well. When he arrived, he was febrile at around 39. He had a raised respiratory rate and a tachycardia. I feel a little bit embarrassed by this slide because I've just come from a critical care session in Hanoi where we've had some lecturers from London talking about the spotting the critically ill adult. And I've written tachypneic without giving a respiratory rate, which is a cardinal sin in their minds. So I didn't have time to change my slides, but it wasn't very high, and he did look very well. He did have an obvious supraclavicular and cervical swelling, which was lymphadenopathy, it felt. Listening to his chest, there were no crackles. It was quite unremarkable. And he had no other adenopathy nor organomegaly in his abdomen. His lab tests were remarkable for a profoundly raised eosinophilia, 6.4. With a normal being less than 0.5, if you're not familiar with these values. His CRP and ESR were raised, but not markedly so. I can't remember the exact figures, but 30 or 40 for each. And his electrolytes and liver function were normal. His chest X-ray was abnormal, and you can see some infiltrates in the left lower zone, and perhaps also adenopathy at the left hilum. Certainly, we were suspicious of this circular shadow. He went on to have a CT, which we didn't have the results of when we saw him, but I'll just show it here. And you can see some nodular shadowing on the left-hand side here, but also some nodules on the right-hand side, which were more difficult to see on the chest X-ray, and on other slices he had adenopathy in his chest as well. So, is there anything else you'd want to ask? I have some questions.
Where has he been?
Okay, yes, we're in a travel medicine symposium, so that seems like a reasonable question. Anything else? 29-year-old man. Perhaps in this day and age we would test him anyway, but we asked about risk factors for HIV. He had none. We also asked about illicit or other drug use, and he hadn't been on any medications or taken any illicit drugs. He'd been on holiday in the US, so he'd spent 3 weeks in the USA, and he'd come back 2 weeks before the onset of the fever. And this is the history that I got from the A&E doctor, which seemed, is that okay? Are we happy with that? They were thinking, they were discounting this fever as relevant.
Where exactly had he been?
Yes, where exactly had he been and what had he been doing? So, with thanks to Ralph Steadman and an illustration from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, very good book. This is pretty much exactly what he'd done. He had driven in a convertible through Arizona. And you'll have noticed from the chest x-rays, they were done in July, so in the summer. So this was a differential diagnosis. I was going to throw this open to the audience, trying to think of things with eosinophilia and lung involvement. But actually, we were most suspicious of number 6, with a slight caveat that I was wondering, couldn't really recall if it was associated with an eosinophilia. We'll come to that later. So we did his HIV serology, which came back as negative. We organized some induced sputum whilst listing him for a bronchoscopy, because our access to bronchoscopy was limited. And he had a lymph node biopsy and some other serologies for those differentials that you saw. This isn't his biopsy, I don't actually have pictures of it, but we got a phone call from the pathologists who were in a different hospital saying, what's going on with this young man? We think he has some sort of worm, but to be honest, I've never seen anything like it before. By this stage, we were fairly happy with our diagnosis, so we were able to tell him that it wasn't a worm infection and that maybe he should read the request form, which quite clearly stated where he had been traveling and what we suspected. And that this was actually related to this, which grew in his microbiology sample. And this is coccidioidomycosis. And the large thing on the previous slide was a spherule, which is one of the stages in the coccidioides life cycle. And coccidioides is endemic in the southwest USA, Mexico, and parts of Central America. Now, when teaching on the Diploma in Tropical Medicine in London, I often tease the Americans for being geographically challenged. But I find that whenever I'm thinking about the US, I am in a similar position and really couldn't put Texas on a map. So I've got some maps of the USA for those of you who are equally blighted as I am. And this is a map showing the endemicity of coccidioides. And this chap had driven essentially from Phoenix to Tucson, I believe it's called, which is right through the highly endemic part for coccidioides. But it stretches across the southwestern USA. It's a dimorphic fungus, so it grows in two forms. And actually, with molecular techniques, two clinically indistinguishable forms have been described, Coccidioides immitis and Coccidioides posidaceae. And I think he would have geographically had the latter, although, as I said, there's no way of clinically distinguishing them and microbiologically either. It's molecular techniques. And they are indeed often associated with eosinophilia, probably more likely than not. And can be a profound eosinophilia. So this all fitted very nicely. This is just a quick look at the life cycle. In the human, you get the lower right forms, and this spherule is about 70 microns across. So it is quite large. If a red cell is about 8 to 10 microns, I think. And this may be the reason that you get the eosinophilic reaction, because this is a large foreign growth, if you like, in the tissues. And this is what we saw in his biopsy. And then in the soil, you get the mold form, if you like, and these Arthraconidia are what get broken off by the wind and get up into the air. And in the summer months, you'll find a lot of people inhaling these in that area and getting infected. Just for contrast, the other two endemic mycoses that the USA suffers from, this is the distribution of Blastomyces, which is further east, and Histoplasma, which I think you can find everywhere, but is particularly endemic again further east. So coccidioides causes around 150,000 infections it is estimated. But a lot of these, the majority are subclinical. It's seasonal, peaking in the summer. And in parts of Arizona, a quarter of community-acquired pneumonia during the peak season will be coccidioides. So it's really quite common. Clinical infection, as I said, is usually acute or subacute pneumonia, but a small proportion of those patients will go on to develop chronic problems, either extrapulmonary or pulmonary problems. There are some very good guidelines from the Infectious Diseases Society for treatment, and I would recommend those. The presenting symptoms, usually pulmonary, can be bilateral or unilateral infiltrates, sometimes with cavities, although usually it's just one or two cavities. Hyaluronidopathy is common, as are nodules. And you can get a more severe form with miliary type disease mimicking TB and a more diffuse or fulminant pneumonia. There's a well-described syndrome of desert rheumatism, which is erythema nodosum combined with fever and arthralgia. And that should suggest this disease in someone who has been in that part of the world. Untreated, or sometimes despite treatment, patients who are diabetic and particularly also smokers and those with fibrotic lung disease can go on to develop a chronic problem with chronic fibrocavitary pneumonia. Patients who have immunodeficiency don't tend to develop this because they tend to develop a more severe diffuse disease or with extrapulmonary disease. Disseminated disease is more common if you're immunosuppressed or pregnant. And there have been studies showing racial differences amongst Americans. And in general, the skin, skeletal system, particularly the knee joint and in the meninges, are the most common sites of spread. You can get a meningitis, and this usually develops as an early complication rather than a late one. And it classically presents quite subacutely, a bit like a cryptococcal meningitis with severe headache that is persisting, perhaps with fever, and going on for days to weeks. And again, they can get a basilar meningitis, sometimes with a vasculitis associated with it. CSF findings are similar to TB, so high protein, low glucose, but you will sometimes find eosinophils in the same way as one does in the blood. Diagnosis. In the southwestern United States, you would have access to a lot of diagnostic possibilities, but for the rest of us, this is where your reference lab usually comes in. There are several serological methods, and most patients who are not immunosuppressed will have positive serology. ELISA is said to be the best screening test in terms of sensitivity. You can culture the organism from sputum, from bronchial aspirates, or from lymph nodes. And histology is also diagnostic. Again, there is a skin test available in the US. I don't think it's available in the UK, and I'm not sure about here. But this isn't recommended for testing an acute infection, as it will remain positive if someone has been exposed ever. And it can be negative in those with overwhelming disease. Treatment, again, I would recommend the guidelines or consultation with an expert. Many patients don't need therapy and they get better on their own. But for those with risks of dissemination, oral azoles may be sufficient, or if they're more sick, starting with amphotericin and then moving on to azoles. And itraconazole and fluconazole are the two azoles that have been well tested. The newer agents, it's less clear how they work in this illness. So our chat was started on some itraconazole, and he was discharged for close follow-up. At 2 to 4 weeks, it's recommended that you check their serology to make sure that it's improving, and these patients need follow-up for a couple of years to ensure they don't get late complications. He did very well. His fever resolved rapidly. His chest x-ray showed improvement. And he was treated for, I think, 6 months, 3 to 6 months being the recommendation. So I think we'll do questions at the end. The next case is a 31-year-old Chinese-American lady who we saw in the Hospital for Tropical Diseases walk-in, and she was 20 weeks pregnant at the time that she attended. She'd had no past medical history, but she and her husband had decided to do a trip to Tanzania because they thought with the coming baby this was their last chance to go on safari, and they really wanted to go on safari. So they had a 9-day trip to Tanzania, returning in August. You can see this was some time ago. And they'd seen a travel health specialist who had said that mefloquine was what they should take for malaria prophylaxis, and that's what they'd done. What exactly had they done? I'm sure you were going to ask. They'd gone on safari and taken some nice pictures of giraffes. And then after their safari, they'd gone to the beach in Zanzibar, just off the coast of Tanzania. Whilst in Zanzibar, they'd been, well, she had been unwell for a couple of days with some watery diarrhea. And she also noticed a spot on her forehead. So after she got back to London, she went for a facial because she thought that all of this time on safari and camping in Tanzania had given her some bad acne. It didn't work. The spot enlarged. And then she came to the hospital about 6 days after her return. The diarrhea and the headache had settled, but in the department she was febrile. And it was also noted that she had some small adenopathy in her neck, and she had some insect bites peripherally. Of course, she had a malaria film, and that was negative, and her bloods were all fairly unremarkable. And based on this, and I wouldn't endorse this management, she was discharged with follow-up. We were contacted 2 days later by phone to say that she'd actually been admitted at the hospital that she was booked to have her baby. She'd attended there just 24 hours after she'd left us because she was worried about her face. She had enlarging nodes, and the bite site was starting to look necrotic, and she had some spreading erythema and swelling on her forehead. The telephone advice was to repeat her blood films daily, and we tried to organize a bed for her at our site to get her across to us. The next day, she had been seen by plastic surgeons who suggested that she have this wound debrided, and she went to theater. They expressed some pus but couldn't find any necrotic or any large amounts of necrotic tissue, and they sent the pus to microbiology. The day after that, we were in now daily discussions with them and trying to organize a bed. Unfortunately, due to changes in the management of the NHS, actually transferring patients between hospitals has become rather difficult, and so we were still unable to get her across. The adenopathy was said to be worsening, though. She consented to having her picture used for educational purposes, and this is a picture of her. And you can see this necrotic site, and I don't think it projects very well, but there is clearly swelling all the way across here. So actually at the referring hospital, they managed to get the diagnosis, and one of the telephone calls told us that they had seen something like this in her film. So they were looking for malaria, but they had seen these flagellated organisms of trypanosoma in her blood film. So this is just a reminder. I think you've already heard a little bit about trypanosomiasis. This is a tsetse fly that was swatted onto the windscreen of one of our colleagues' Land Rover whilst they were on safari, and shows very nicely the hatchet cell just here. Looks like a meat cleaver that distinguishes the tsetse fly, which is the vector for this disease. You will remember that there are two types of African trypanosomiasis: Trypanosoma brucei gambiense, West African sleeping sickness, and Trypanosoma brucei rhodesiense, East African sleeping sickness. This is a little bit out of date because treatment for stage two would now be with combination therapy. But this lady had been on safari here in Tanzania, and Zanzibar is here, but she will have caught this on safari. So she had East African trypanosomiasis. So then we came on to how to manage her. You see, there for West African, stage one treatment, where disease is confined to the blood and lymphatic system, pentamidine is the mainstay of treatment, but for East African, Suramin is recommended. So there started a rapid review of the literature. Could we use Suramin in pregnancy? Well, rather worryingly, Suramin has been used to develop a model for preeclampsia in rats. So if you inject rats with Suramin, you get a reasonable model of preeclampsia for you to do further tests on. But the good news is that it doesn't seem to cross the placenta. In humans, there were some case reports in the second trimester of pregnancy. But then, quite helpfully, Suramin was used quite extensively as a preventative for onchocerciasis programs in, I think, the 1950s and 60s, without any documentation of teratogenicity or ill effect. So that was quite reassuring to us. Pentamidine, meanwhile, there was some evidence of an effect in rats, but there's a reasonable literature of use of IV pentamidine in pregnant women, largely because it has a wider indication for use, particularly in HIV infections. And this was actually recommended by the CDC, despite the fact that most textbooks say that there is primary resistance of East African trypanosomiasis to pentamidine. So what to do? So when she arrived, she was febrile, she was tachypneic and tachycardic, apologies again. She was saturating well on air, and she had some signs of infection in her chest. Her bloods showed a pancytopenia, which is something that you will commonly see in trypanosomiasis, mildly elevated liver enzymes, and a really marked CRP. I don't think her chest x-ray projects very well, but we were worried about a right lower zone pneumonia, and this was a lady who had recently had intubation for debriding of her forehead. The blood film that we performed confirmed the diagnosis that had been made in the referring hospital. So treatment. So we gave her fluids, and we chose IV ceftazidime to cover her for the possibility of an infection related to her period of intubation. And we decided that we should be giving her Suramin. Unfortunately, we were out of stock. So there followed this, as you would guess, happened before a bank holiday weekend on a Friday night. And there followed a series of telephone calls around all of the hospitals in the UK that we could think of that had infectious diseases departments, asking if they had Suramin. It was quite a sort of one of those life-affirming evenings where you'd phone up, speak to the pharmacist. Pharmacist would be at home, they'd say, I'll go into the hospital. 2 hours later, they've gone into the hospital and they're phoning you back and saying, sorry, we've looked, but we don't have any. And oh, by the way, there's a little note that says, if we're asked for Suramin, we should phone the Hospital for Tropical Diseases in London, because they're supposed to have some. Yeah. So then we started thinking about an alternative, and she was deteriorating now with worsening shock, acidosis, and gas exchange, so we needed a plan. Now, one of the complications of trypanosomiasis, East African trypanosomiasis, that causes fatality is a myocarditis. So faced with her deteriorating cardiac function, we organized for her to be screened for myocarditis, and ECGs and troponins were sent and were happily negative, and she had an echocardiogram which did not show any signs of this. But we decided we had to treat her with something. So pentamidine was available, and we gave her some pentamidine and transferred her to the intensive care unit as, if you like, a holding measure. We also informed the obstetric team so that they could check that the placenta and the baby were all functioning well with the treatments that she was about to have. We dispatched one of our junior doctors to Switzerland, where we had located some serum in, to pick some up and bring it back. Later found out she was afraid of flying. Treatment continued once we had the serum in, and after a few days she had a lumbar puncture. And this was a real moment of worry, because if she was going to need treatment for stage 2 trypanosomiasis, we were going to be in real trouble, and the baby was going to be in real trouble. Happily, that was blameless. She developed some mild proteinuria, but nothing more severe than that, and monitoring of her placental blood flow by the obstetric team showed no problems there. She was discharged from hospital, and shortly thereafter, she gave birth to a perfectly healthy little girl.